welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Duncan Speakman modestly describes himself as an outsider artist and a jack of all trades, with no formal arts training and experience gained as a composer, sound engineer, documentary post-production, digital artist, and now writer. His walking pieces have delighted me for years, and although I thought he might describe them as immersive, taking you away from your surroundings, he likes to think that his work is making you more present in the city, using sounds and music in ways to shape our experience. I was lucky to catch him between performances of his latest work, It Must Have Been Dark By Then, which was being played at the British Library. We tried to find some quiet streets away from the busy Euston Road, covering much of the territory that this latest walking piece had drawn me through. Well, I've just taken part in what I think you'd describe as an audio performance, but maybe you can tell me.
I'm struggling with what to call it at the moment. Actually, I've been interviewing people afterwards and asking how they would describe it to a friend if someone asked them what they'd just done. And some people describe it as a book that they read while walking that has a soundtrack, and some people describe it as an audio walk that has a book with it. So people sort of have a preference as to what it feels like. For me, I think it's an audio walk. I have a big problem with the word immersive. It's become a sort of kind of catchphrase for experimental performance stuff. And the reason I don't think this kind of work is immersive is because it's making you present in the world. It's really trying to deal with the space that's around you. So it's not immersing you in the work. I like to think the work is making you present in the city. That's why I always sort of try and steer away from calling it immersive. If people want to call it that, it's fine.
Okay, so I'm walking along beside someone who is multi-skilled, and you're often getting
Jack of all trades. That's
jack
what it
of
is.
All, jack and of all trades. And multitasking, you get people to do things, all sorts of different things, but you do lots of things yourself. So would you like to sort of try to describe who or what you are?
You know, I always say I'm a composer, actually. You know, historically and in my personal background, I've always come from a position of working with music and sound, and what's just kind of happened over time is I've just developed that into using sound and music as a way of shaping our experience of the city and environments we're in as we're walking through them. I have been working with text a lot, but the text for me is quite often a way of just facilitating that experience. I think the emotional core of it, if I can say that, or, you know, the things I'm trying to say personally within the work, I always trying to do through sound and music in a way.
And how did it all begin?
Potted history is musician, sound engineer, documentary post-production, then learned how to use computers and started being a digital artist, making interactive installations and quite specifically interactive documentaries, but no one wanted to broadcast those. They sort of accidentally got picked up by a gallery and I got some art commissions, and so I accidentally became an artist.
Because you've not got sort of formal artistic training.
No, I have outsider artist. Is that what you get called if you haven't had the proper training? Picked it up. I've worked with great people, that's what I'd say. I've had amazing collaborations over the years with. My name is on this work. The last 5-6 years I've been working under this collective name of Circumstance because I wanted to move away from that idea of the individual artist doing everything, because I do work with an amazing group of different people who input in lots of different ways, whether that's through conceptual ideas or editing or music. So my route into it came from doing sound and digital things, and I was making these short form videos, these sort of video blogs in the pre-YouTube days, which were just short observational films of something in the street. Then I composed a little soundtrack for it, and that was that. And then I got invited by Hewlett-Packard to do some work with their early locative media research. And I wasn't really someone who walked around with headphones. I wasn't a Walkman user. And I walked around listening to some of the soundtracks from the short films I'd made, and I was just, oh, this is the same. This is just, I don't have to film it, though. I just put people in the street, and they same kind of experience of seeing an everyday scene soundtracked by something I'm trying to say musically about it.
That is the thing, isn't it? It's because what the audio does, and certainly the way you developed the most recent one, which I've just done, it allows the participant to imagine the scenes themselves. So it's like they create the cinema view.
Yeah, definitely.
They develop the frame or film
itself.
It's
always been a little bit like the kind of the naive hippie aesthetic for me is that if something gets filmed, if it gets made into cinema or documentary, we watch it because we somehow think it's important because someone's decided to film it. So my thinking was always, well, if you can make the everyday, if you can make the world you already live in feel like cinema, then maybe you treat it with more importance. Maybe you stop ignoring it and you pay attention to it in the same way you might pay attention to media. That's the underlying thing that's gone through a lot of the walking sound work for a long time.
And the majority of it is around walking, isn't it?
I mean, there's a bunch of reasons for that. One is just about the fact that physical engagement that you have to have with an environment when you're moving through it, that you have to be aware of it in so much more, whether it's the texture of the ground under your feet or whether it's moving out the way of people. It's like this constant interaction with the world. And I think people have said, oh, you know, this interactive walk you've made. And it's kind of funny because sometimes it's just a pre-recorded fixed audio file. You know, there's no interaction in the media, but the interaction that people have to engage with it is massive and constant.
Is that because inevitably it's a narrative and a walk is a narrative? It's an unfolding journey in front of you?
Exactly. I've always called it a narrative of experience rather than, telling us a narrative story. They experience a narrative just because they're going through those things. You know, I like the idea that when you send someone down an alley and then it pops out into a big courtyard, that's a really big jump in lots of different ways, and you can think of that as an edit. Or so composing, when I've done routes where I'm choosing the route and I'm telling people where to go, it's very much about trying to use the architectural space as a way of creating different scenes and making that kind of, you know, sequenced visual poetry in the same way you'd make a narrative if you were editing a film.
Well, what's so exciting, I think, is that you're stretching yourself and you're also demanding things from the technology at the same time. And obviously what the technology is allowing you to do is something beyond cinema. So I know one or two of your works, but people listening to this may not. But have I sort of summed that up fairly?
I think that's right. I mean, I think the funny thing is a lot of the stuff I make, it's not actually pushing the technology that much. It's not going to win any awards for technological innovation. Or what I try to do anyway is try to use the things that are existing, you know, quite often these kind of technologies we're already carrying around, and try and rethink what their role is, what they can do to our experience. You know, there's a lot of really great writing by people like Michael Bull and Jean-Paul Thibault about the Walkman experience, about walking in the city with headphones. And that's mostly based around the Walkman culture of people choosing the music they play and how people shape their experience by choosing the music. And so for me it's just, well, if they're going to do that, why, I could do that for them. And that's the offer I make, I guess.
I've just undertaken the one that's most recent.
Yeah.
But I also undertook Hollow Body.
Mm.
That was commissioned by the Museum of London?
Yes. Yeah. Generally, I don't do sort of client-based commissions. You know, the kind of, can you make an audio tour about the history of this place? It's just not... It's not me. There's lots of people who do great works like that, and it's not my kind of field. But the Museum of London basically said, no, you just do what you normally do. It's just got to finish at the museum. That was the ruling. And the exhibition's about Sherlock Holmes, so think about that. So we kind of drew on a lot of... there's a lot of Sherlock Holmes in there, but it's quite buried. And the actual experience is about the architecture of the city and the city as a body and trust between you and the person you're doing the walk with.
Well, now you see that you've touched on what I was quite intrigued by with that, which was that as a double hander, I think that develops more, I don't know, interaction. Some other works that you've done have been very individual, but when I mentioned Subtle Mob, what I thought was also telling about that was that you, from what I remember, we were split into two groups. There was sort of one group that was being observed by the other.
But it's swapped backwards and forwards.
So exactly.
So sometimes you're observing, sometimes you're following instructions, and it sort of becomes a bit more blurred as it goes along. So in the Subtle Mob, you did it in pairs as well, but your pair would be doing the same thing. So one half of the audience would be a group of pairs. And the reason I did that in that very early stage was because
you can make much richer imagery with two people. The amount of things you can kind of create experientially, so in that there's a moment where one person is invited to sit on their own and the other person walks over to them and puts their hand on their shoulder, and it sort of creates this whole scene and this image which you can't do if you're walking that kind of piece on your own. And that was why we had two people in that. Hollow Body was for two people, but for that reason as well, that you can create different imagery and you can position each other as kind of protagonists in the scene. So, you know, when they appear on a bridge, they become a sort of figure in this journey, in this narrative. But it was also because all of Sherlock Holmes was about double X. You know, it was all about duo relationships. And so that felt like we were meeting the brief and having some connection to Sherlock Holmes in that way. Because Hollow Body doesn't really deal with the history of the city. There's some references to it, but it's the piece is very much divided between the old and the new city. So you start by St. Paul's, and you work your way into the modern city. And then the middle section takes you just on the edge of the London Wall and through these older streets before it returns you into the Barbican. So it does these different historical spaces as the narrative structure without ever having to talk about that. It's just you're actually there. But when we first started making that piece, one of the things we did was invite Phil Smith from Rites and Sights and Mythogeography and all those things to give us a guided tour of the area. And he doesn't really know much about that area, just to see how he would investigate a place like that.
Because that was site-specific, but yeah. The piece of work that you've created, that I've just tried,
yeah.
is not site-specific. What draws you more? Is it trying to get individuals to interact with the spaces around them or interact differently with groups around them? Or is it that you want to be site-specific or site-responsive? There are two questions in there, and I'm being a bit mean.
I don't think I'm drawn specifically to one or the other. I find them both really interesting ways to work, and I think each offers different things. You know, the site-specific work offers a chance to really have a kind of control over how the space is used in the piece. The site-responsive work, the one where we don't know where it is, offers a kind of agency to the listener or the participant where they are more actively exploring a place. Yeah, I think they're just different things. I don't think I like one more than the other. I like doing both. There's something nice about making this piece. For the last few years, Hollow Body is the only piece that anyone could do in Europe, actually. All the other ones we've been doing have been in China and Japan, and they've all been quite site-specific. It's a bit frustrating making site-specific pieces because you limit the amount of people that can actually experience it. But it is a way of engaging with the place. I mean, you know, there's only one Taj Mahal, and you go to the Taj Mahal to experience the Taj Mahal. So, you know, a site-specific work, there's a reason why it's site-specific. It's about a place. But it's nice to make things that are open and let people explore different environments and different places.
Can we ask you, how do you go about making one of your pieces? Do you capture something in your mind, like a potential soundtrack or a pen? I mean, do you start from music? Where does it all come from?
Yes.
And what's the process? Without revealing if you're...
I'm all up for revealing stuff.
Alchemy.
It depends on the piece, of course, but there are a few things that regularly happen in the process. So one of the things is it generally starts from a concept. It generally starts from a piece about X or a piece about Y. There's something I'm interested in, there's something that I think I want to make, and it's generally always related to mobile listening and walking, just because of the things I was saying earlier about getting people engaged with space and my tension around mobile technology being really good at connecting us to remote places but distancing us from where we are. It's something I've kind of been jabbering on about for years now. It's like I just want to use that same technology to force you to engage with where you are. So that's one starting point. And then what happens very often is myself and Sarah Anderson will sketch out some music.
Just fill in Sarah's...
Sarah Anderson is a composer who I've worked with on soundtracks for these pieces and some of the concepts for developing these pieces for nearly 10 years now, I guess. And so we'll sketch some rough improvised music. Yeah, so we sketch out some music and then we walk the music. If it's a site-specific piece, we walk the location listening to sketches of music we've done and we see what it kind of evokes about the location for us. Or
so you're not doing it quite the other way around. I interviewed Julian Rickett of One Step at a Time Like This, and he said that they first went out and created their own music and then went round an area. But then they realised that the area itself evoked a very different type of music, so they would rather walk an area first and then work with local artists who were working in the area and use their music.
Right. But we're composers. I mean, that's it's the way I say things, I guess, in a way. That's, you know, through the music. So, I mean, we do sometimes collaborate with local musicians. In Japan, we made a walk there and we worked with a lot of local musicians to make that. That kind of comes in. But what the main thing is that if we don't know, I guess it lets us see things in a certain way. And then we'll go back and we'll rewrite the music and draw out the bits we want. And this piece had a different process, though. This piece had a slightly stranger process, which is I asked Sarah to... I made a 40-minute click track, you know, like a metronome. The texture of it slowly developed, but essentially it was a 40-minute metronome. And I asked her to play a 40-minute improvisation, thinking about slow, gradual change. That was the shape of the brief. And so she made this long form, amazing performance, actually. And then when I travelled around the three locations, did the three field trips, I would listen to this in each location just to, how do I describe it, to kind of give everything I was doing at some kind of cohesion, so that when I was in Latvia or Tunisia, you know, two very different places, there was something in my experience that was tied between the two, and there was this kind of bed of music. And then once I came back with all the material, I then went back into the studio with another artist, Sean McGee and Sarah, and I played them interviews and field recordings, and we sort of improvised ideas around the themes. And then I went out and walked those, you know, to see whether they worked with the themes. And yeah, so it kind of goes backwards and forwards. So that's the kind of soundtrack writing process. I guess the other part of it is you do build a box of tricks in a way. And the certain ways I've kind of developed of writing text and instructions that work better than other ones I've done, like over the years, they've got better. It's about leaving space for the world to happen. It's about being able to set a question to sort of provoke a thought or a way of looking at things, and then give the audience enough time to actually have that experience. That's quite a way of sequencing things in a way. So there's a funny thing where people come back and are sort of surprised by the serendipity of moments. They're like, oh, you know, just read this and then I saw this. And part of that just comes because we really push for them to be, sometimes subconsciously, sometimes overtly, but thinking about that thing. So then they naturally tend to, you know, you find this cohesion in your environment, and you suddenly, if your brain's thinking about it, you see it and you make your own connection with it.
But I can imagine there's a... This is a really time-consuming stuff, because... You've got to... build the score, kind of thing. As you say, if you go interviewing people and want to include interviews, you're going to have to do a significant amount of editing, studio time to put all that together. And then I imagine you're probably going to have to sketch things out. Maybe you're so good you can do it in your head, but I can imagine there's a bit of sketching out.
There's a lot of sketching, lots of rolled out sheets of paper. This one...
And do you rehearse things as well?
Yeah, so they go through lots of testing phases. So you start with a small version, you try it out and you see how it works, and then that sometimes reveals things that you didn't know. And some things come about through happy accidents. With the subtle mob, the end of that came about because when we were testing it, one of the people that was testing it, the battery ran out on their MP3 player just at this kind of crescendo in the music. And they said it was amazing because they were just thrown back into the world. Like, it was this real, like, being kicked out of this thing straight back into the world. And we're like, that's brilliant. That's how we want it to end. So, you know, so then we sort of designed that into the piece to really do this kick out at the end. The hardest thing with this piece, actually, with This Must Have Been Dark by Then, is because people choose their own routes and their own locations, working out the time frames of that was really hard, because I had no sort of model for how do you map out a compositional arc of something when you don't know how long it's going to take. So there's a lot of weird little techniques going on in the background of this piece, where I use a lot of expectations that we have in Western musical structure around. There'll be sections when you're kind of invited to be looking for something, and the music will have a certain kind of harmonic progression that is almost predictable, that is what we would kind of expect. And then at a certain point, it'll sort of resolve itself into something much more static and unmoving. And the idea with that is that if you're walking listening, you might not be very conscious of it, but it sort of gives you this sense of, oh, okay,
stuff stopped happening, I should probably move on and I should find somewhere. And I've been starting to measure the way people move and travel through this piece. Timing that they go through, no matter what kind of area, a size of area they walk, has been almost the same for everyone. You know, you get a leeway of about 5-10 minutes. Some people, you know, there's obviously a few people who go for a crazy long journey, but generally, yeah, very, very similar in the arc of people. So that works really well for us, that even though the piece seems like it has a lot of agency and you're really kind of choosing your own journeys and doing your own thing, it's kind of amazing how similar each person's is in a way.
So that may well be anyway the school that's doing that.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand that at the moment. I don't really have any answers yet, but I'm trying to sort of...
Because I think it could bring in sound effects that got people to quicken their pace.
Well, I do that with the rhythms in the music. I started realising a while ago when I started measuring how people were, the speed people were moving through the sound walks I was making, that if you asked them about the experience, they wouldn't notice any introduction of rhythm in the music. But if you looked at the speed they're walking, everyone accelerated at the same rate at the same point. It was kind of, okay, so this actually kind of works. But at the same time, it does help me give it a shape. It helps me think about how I shape the composition.
I went to the panel discussion a couple of evenings ago, and you admitted you were a complete control freak.
Yeah.
So maybe you are trying to control the participants.
If you make a film, you want people to be facing the screen, you want the speakers on either side of the screen, you want it at the aspect ratio that you filmed at, you know, all these kind of things. So I kind of think about it in that way. Just because mine's happening in an uncontrolled sort of urban space or wherever it is, there's still a piece I'm trying to make, and so that's where all those bits of control freakness come in. And this piece has been very strange for me to sort of get. I've given over a lot with this in terms of letting people choose their own routes, and they might go to some places that I would never have made a site-specific walk in. And I don't know what people are experiencing. That's a weird one too. It's I'm you know, sending people out to do this, and I don't really have a clue what they're experiencing. So, yeah.
I usually ask people to recommend a couple of walks.
In London, I think it's still available, and it probably still works with geography, but Platform's piece and While London Burns. There's certain things about the style of some of the audio I'm not so into, but I think as a full work, it's not really like anything else. And I think it does this mixture of being a scored musical work and something that deals with the complexities of that space incredibly well. I just think it's, yeah, I think it's a really great piece.
Well, maybe suggest something from your own work.
I quite like A Hollow Body. I think that's a good piece. This one, It Must Have Been Dark By Then, will be on tour. We're planning a sort of tour of libraries, and then it'll be in Stavanger in Norway in October, and hopefully in Amsterdam in November. I was just told about a piece. It's not a walk that I really want to do, which is by French and Mottishead, and I can't remember the name of it. But it's a piece that you listen to on headphones lying down in a wood, and it's about the decomposition of your body if it were to be dead in the wood. And someone was just describing it to me yesterday, and it sounds amazing. I haven't done it, but I really want to try that piece.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Duncan Speakman. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.